Well, that's a parable you probably haven't heard preached very often. I'm not sure I've preached from it before. It does tend to be one that gets people scratching their heads somewhat, trying to work out what on earth Jesus is saying. The difficulty really that we have with this parable comes in chapter 16 and verse 8, that the master, who has just been ripped off by his steward, then commends the steward for dealing shrewdly. That's probably the most confusing part of the parable. But I want you just to not worry about that for the time being. We will get to verse 8 as we work our way through it, and I promise you that when we get to verse 8, it will make sense, and you'll be able to see what's going on. I also need to translate for you, I suppose, or perhaps at least for some of you, what is meant in verses 9, 11, and 13 by this word mammon. I've never used the word mammon. I find it difficult even to pronounce. In my life, I don't think. But as many of you will know, we can simply just translate it as money or wealth, that kind of idea. So if you are confused by mammon, that's what that means. Well, let's go back to the beginning of the parable and try and understand what it is that Jesus is saying. With all these parables, the whole point of the parable is to speak a heavenly truth into a very down-to-earth situation. And sometimes we can get a little bit confused by Jesus' parables, because Jesus' down-to-earth is not necessarily the same as our down-to-earth. In other words, 21st century Clydach is not identical to 1st century Palestine, and as a consequence we can miss some of the nuances here. But what we find in chapter 16 and verse 1 is that there was a rich man who had a steward. There are various rich men in Jesus' parables. The majority of the rich men in Jesus' parables tend to be people who are, well, fairly unrighteous. In fact, the rich men that we find in the Gospels tend to be fairly unrighteous. And it's likely that this man, this rich man, was probably not entirely scrupulous himself. In the first century, there wasn't much in the way of a middle class. The rich, therefore, tended to get rich at the expense of the poor. And unless they'd inherited wealth and then became suddenly generous, most rich people had a fairly bad view held of them by society. Zacchaeus was by no means unique, in other words. And this rich man, it seems in this story, was probably fairly unscrupulous. I'll explain more about why that might be as we go through. But he had a steward, and the steward's job was basically to manage the day-to-day affairs of this rich man. So the rich man essentially could sit at home with his glass of wine, put in his feet up, while his servants brought him food and so on, and actually the hard work of making sure that his estate or whatever it be was making money, well, that was a job of somebody else. That was the job of a steward. And in order to accomplish that, stewards had a pretty free hand as to what they could do under the authority of this man. This steward was able somehow not to do his job particularly well. He was wasting this man's goods. We don't know how he was doing that. It doesn't seem that he was necessarily stealing them for himself. I think the text would say that if it was. It's just that he wasn't using his resources all that well. Perhaps he was investing in businesses that weren't able to repay. Perhaps he was being a bit lazy. We're not entirely sure, but whatever it was, it fell short of stealing, but he just wasn't very good at his job. He wasn't getting a good return on his master's money, and he was wasting his goods. So the master called and said to him, "What's this I hear about you? Give an account," verse 2, "of your stewardship." In other words, he wants the man to go back, get the account books and everything, and the rich man is going to do an audit of the account books. Well, the steward rather than fight in his corner, as you might expect, well, it's not been a great year for the grape harvest, or whatever else he might have said, or I was ripped off by so-and-so, it's not really my fault. He doesn't do any of that. He seems to kind of almost accept it, almost as if he's been waiting for this to happen. He knows, perhaps, that he's not a great steward, maybe. So he doesn't argue or fight, but he immediately begins to formulate a cunning plan, Drake would say. So, what does his cunning plan? Well, he begins by thinking of what he can't do in verse 3. He can't dig. Manual labor's not for him. All right? He's ashamed to beg. How's he going to get any money? Here's his plan in verse 4. When I'm sacked from this job, I want to be able to walk into another job. How am I going to do that? Well, as the story unfolds, we discover what he's decided to do. Verse 5, he calls each one of his master's debtors. It seems that he calls them one at a time. And he says to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he's obviously got his own kind of bill of accounts here, very probably the account book that the master has asked for to do the audit with. He brings this account book with him. How much is it? 100 measures. Let's make it 50. In today's money, a very rough estimation, according to the commentaries, 50 measures of oil, what he's knocked off the bill, £20,000-£30,000 perhaps, something around that sort of figure. Not a small amount of money, but not an enormous amount of money. It's not millions of pounds. £20,000 or £30,000. Now, if you were in that situation, okay, so if you owed somebody, let's say, £40,000, £50,000, £60,000, and then somebody from that person came to you without any asking any questions, without trying to do a deal, without saying, well, I know you're going through some difficult circumstances and therefore we'll perhaps pay it back over a longer period of... Nothing like that. Just says, look, make it 20, make it half the amount. You're going to be a little bit suspicious, aren't you? Something not quite right here. But depending on the sort of person you are, you might think, well, this chance isn't going to come along very quickly again. Quick, give me the pen. I'll sign quick. It's the steward. He's got the proper account book. I'm putting my name in before he changes his mind. That sounds to me as what's going on. Don't ask any questions. Just, can you see it in verse 6? Sit down quickly and write 50. Don't ask any questions. Has anyone ever come to you and say, well, here's the amount. Don't ask any questions. As soon as they say that, you know, hang on, I need to ask some questions here. But these people didn't ask questions. He goes to the next person now. How much do you owe? 100 measures of wheat. He doesn't half this man's bill. He just knocks 20% off. But it's a similar kind of figure overall, £20,000-£30,000, something like that. So here's this steward now, who's not been a very good steward, who's been wasting his master's resources, not using them well, but now he's got two good friends. He's got two good friends. But you'd also might think, well, all right, he's made two good friends, but he's also made one big enemy in his master. So it's a real surprise to us to find in verse 8 that the master commends the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. Now, what do we make of this? Why would the master commend somebody who's just ripped him off to the tune of, let's say, 60,000 quid? And that's a good question. I think that as the master commends the unjust steward, he does it something like this. Remember, he's asked for the account books. He gets the account books in. He's looking through them to do his little audit. And he perhaps starts at the back, as it were, where the most recent entries are. And he sees a bunch of entries for today with his debts halved. And he says, you cunning so-and-so. Probably a more colourful word than so-and-so. It's that kind of commendation. He's not saying, you're the greatest steward who ever lived. It's not that. You cunning so-and-so. And there is a sense in which, yes, there is some admiration for this man's cunning. Why this admiration? Well, because the rich man has probably done similar kinds of things himself in the past. He's probably someone who is shrewd and maybe at times unjust himself. And it takes a thief to recognize a thief in a certain sense. He understands what this man has done. And although he's on the one hand annoyed that he's been ripped off, on the other hand, there is a sense of admiration for the cunningness, the shrewdness of the way in which this man has dealt. And actually for the rich man, 40, 50,000 quid, it's not a big deal for the rich man. It's not a huge deal. It's not millions of pounds, which his estate is probably worth in today's money. It's enough to notice, but not enough necessarily to get too upset. So he commends the unheard because he has dealt shrewdly. And then Jesus makes this comment, "The sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light." So he's wanting us to think of these quite worldly people now. The whole story is about worldly people. We've got the rich man, who seems to be a lover of wealth. He's always wanted to make more money and so on. He's got these other people with fairly significant debts towards him. He's a big time dealer. In other words, he's very rich. If you can afford to lend £100,000, £150,000 to somebody else, you've obviously got much more than that yourself. That's why I think he probably could have managed to cope with this losing the wolf. These are worldly people. The steward is obviously a worldly person, worldly wise. The people who have had the debts. Again, they're not sort of little tenant farmers who are just trying to keep their family going. They don't owe their master £100,000 or so. These are other wealthy businessmen who owe him money, who have been quite happy not to ask any questions and just get their debt paid down. They're all very worldly, these people. These are sons of this world. And how have they handled things? Well, they've all been very shrewd, haven't they? And they've all been very careful. What are they trying to do? Well, they're all trying to win friends and therefore perhaps influence people. So the steward, in other words, he's trying to win the friendship of those other two debtors. And maybe he's done so. What are the debtors trying to do? Well, they're trying to reduce their debt even more so they can make even more money and build up even more of their wealth. And the master? Well, the master could well be within his rights to prosecute this man for what he's done. But it seems that he chooses not to. And maybe even for this master, he kind of can see a sort of sense of good coming in the story for him. He's got rid of his steward that he wanted to get rid of, but also there's a sense in which his other people in the neighborhood may well think even more highly of him. His generosity, maybe those people might be even more willing to lend off him in the future, so he can gain even more money in the future. Good might come of this, you know. I might be able to make this work for my advantage. People in that situation are very often thinking that way. They all seem to be thinking this way. I can make this work for my advantage. And Jesus is saying, look, the world is better at doing that than the sons of light, than believers, than followers of God. Now, you might think for a moment, well, hang on, of course they are. We shouldn't be behaving like that, should we? We shouldn't always be thinking, how can I make this work for myself? How can I get the most out of this situation? We shouldn't be thinking about that. We should be loving the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength. We should be loving our neighbor as ourselves. Why does Jesus seem to suggest here that we can learn from the world in always getting things for yourself and trying to make things work for yourself? Well, Jesus is going to explain what he means. And what he means is this. We should learn from the way the world handles what's important to them, how we should handle what's apparently important to us. Does that make sense? We should learn from the way that the world handles what's important to them to handle what should be important to us. In other words, we should learn from how rich men and lovers of money handle money to see how we should handle things of spiritual value. That's the point Jesus is making, and he'll explain that in more detail in verses 9 to 13. So let's go through that detail, and you'll see the point that Jesus is making. Yes, we can learn from the unjust steward, not by being unjust, but by learning from him the importance of seeing how can I benefit from this, and in our case, benefit from it spiritually. Verse 9 then, Jesus says, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon. I can't say it. I'm just going to use the word money. Is that okay? By unrighteous money, all right? Make friends for yourself by unrighteous money. Okay. So that when you fail, or perhaps when it fails, they may receive you into an everlasting home. So the question I'm asking now is, what sort of friends is Jesus speaking of? Okay, in the way that we use unrighteous money. So the unjust steward, he's made friends of two other businessmen who might give him a job for a year or two and keep a very close eye on what he's doing as well if he does get a job. He may get a job for a year or two. But we are to make friends with the way that we use money. That those friends won't give us a job for a year or two. Those friends would receive us into an everlasting home. So a simple question, what sort of friend could give you an everlasting home? Well, I only know of one. All right, God or the Lord Jesus. Okay, so that's what we're to do. In the way that we use even worldly wealth, unrighteous money, the way that we use that should make us friends with God. In other words, money itself isn't evil, but the way that we use money might well be, if we're greedy, if we're selfish, and so on. So we're to use this money that we have, the resources that God has given us, what? Well, for God's glory, not for our own. We're to use it, as it were, to make friends with God. And you understand, of course, not in the sense of, let's try and bribe God. If I give God £1,000 every year, maybe he'll let us into heaven. You understand, of course, that's not what God is saying. He's saying, use this worldly wealth for the sake of good things, of righteous things, and you can do that. And then, when you fail, in other words, when you run out of money, or you run out of resources, when you die, in other words, he will then receive you into an everlasting home because you've got the right sort of friends. We can learn from the world in that. Often the world is looking for influence and the right sort of friends. We can learn from that. The greatest friend we can possibly have is God himself. So why don't we live in a way that makes God our friend? That's the encouragement. That's what's good for us if we do that. And then we have the lessons that we can learn from it. Verse 10, he who is faithful in what is least is also faithful in much. Jesus says similar things in other parables. He who is unjust in what is least is also unjust in much. In other words, if here on earth, the riches we have here on earth aren't very much, generally for most of us, certainly compared to the wealth of heaven, nothing at all. Mere trinkets, just little things. But what God is saying here, what the Lord Jesus is saying here, is God will look at the way that we handle the resources that God has given us here on earth, and he will take that into consideration when he considers what riches to give us in heaven. And if we haven't handled our riches on earth, then we won't be trusted with much in heaven. Now you might be slightly, perhaps surprised by me talking about riches in heaven and so on and looking after things in heaven, but it's fairly clear from the New Testament, particularly the parables that that Jesus told and also some things that the Apostle Paul makes clear, that there are rewards in heaven. And those rewards are often, perhaps even always, in the way of responsibility over certain things in heaven. We're not sure exactly responsibility over what, but certainly responsibility over perhaps people, perhaps resources in heaven. And the people who can be trusted here will be given a greater reward there. That's what Jesus is talking about. So this unjust steward, let's go back to him a moment. All right, he's used this worldly wealth. He's trying to get what's best for himself. I'm going to get sacked, but maybe I can get a little something from another master. Actually, what are those masters going to give him? Is he going to get a steward's job somewhere else? Would you give this guy a steward's job? I wouldn't. He's not going to get a steward's job somewhere else. He probably knows that. He's been shrewd. But everyone knows he's kind of gone under the radar, as it were. And therefore, the other guys will know he can't really be trusted. Yeah, they owe him a favor, certainly. They might give him a little job. And it might be better than digging holes, but he's not going to be a manager any longer. Perhaps a table servant, something like that, perhaps. Earning, you know, maybe 10,000, 12,000 pounds or something, you know, a third or so of what he's got for them. That's perhaps all. Because they can't trust him. They know they can't trust him. What of us then? That's the question, isn't it? Think about the resources you've been given. The money that you earn or is given to you. The teaching that you receive Sunday by Sunday and midweek and in your own devotions and study times. Think of the skills that you have that are unique to you, the experiences that God has led you in that maybe he hasn't led other people in. Think of the time that you have. All of these things added together are the resources which God has given to us. How do we use them? Do we use them in such a way that God would look on that and say, well, there's a man or a woman after my own heart. There's someone who's a real friend of me. They're doing things just as I would do them. They're using their resources just as I would use them. Is that how God looks on us as we use our time, our energy, our money, our things? Is that what we do? Because that's what the world does. But is that what we do? Are we seeking spiritual riches, in other words? Because what could be better? That's part of what Jesus is saying here. What could be better than riches in heaven? What could be better than spiritual riches? What could be better than being closer to the throne of Jesus Christ in heaven? What could be better than that? Because what we should be seeking after is far greater than what the world is often seeking after. So how much more then should we pursue that compared with the way that some people in the world pursue money and riches or fame or pleasure or whatever it is that their heart is set upon? How much more should we pursue Christ? And if we live in such a way that invests, as it were, in our relationship with God, then how much a benefit that will be, not just for us, but by God's grace then through to everyone. Again, I want to create a clear distinction. We're not trying to bribe God here. We're not trying to pay God off. It's not that there's a price to pay, and if we donate £1 million, we can get a seat on the board. It's nothing like that. God is simply saying, look, I've given you much. How much have you made of it? How much have you made of what I've given you? It's the parable of the talents, in other words, isn't it? So, therefore, in verse 11, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, in the worldly wealth, who will commit to your trust the true riches? If we can't even look after money, which has little value, why should God, for example, entrust us to look after souls? It's one of the reasons why one of the qualifications for an elder or a pastor is that he's not a lover of money. How can God do that? He can't, of course, and won't. So we need to use our resources, our worldly wealth, well. If you've not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? You see, we're starting to see that the steward's cunning plan is not quite as cunning as he thought it was. Because they realize they've ripped off his master. They're not going to give him that job he perhaps wants, as we've said. And the Lord, you see, has given us his resources. The cattle on 1,000 hills is the Lord. It all belongs ultimately to him. Your car, your house, your bank balance, they're all his. So if you've not been faithful in what is his, who will give you what is your own, your reward? We've got, in other words, to make good use of the resources that God has loaned to us. And then we get this final section, which is this final verse, which is much more familiar perhaps with us than the parable itself. No servant can serve two masters. Well, that's been clear in the story, hasn't it? This unrighteous steward stopped serving his own master and started serving these other two masters. Even though he wasn't technically employed by them, he's now serving them and not his own master. He couldn't serve both. Do you see in the story? So he's hating the one, his own master, who sacked him, and he's loving the other. Or it will be the other way around. And so parable ends with this very clear word: you cannot serve God and worldly wealth. In other words, what we can't do is say, I love God, and at the same time said, I love money. We can't do that. We have to say either, I hate money and I love God, or I hate God and love money. God is saying, Jesus is saying very, very clearly, those are the only two options. So, what is it for us? It's a serious question. What is it for us? Where is our heart? Because that's where our treasure will be. It's so easy, isn't it, to get wrapped up in the things of this world and to love money, to want what other people have got. The nicer car, the bigger house, the better holiday, whatever it might be. It's easy to want that. We all fall into the trap at times, don't we? But the problem is paying for those things can often mean we're not investing in what really matters, in the spiritual good of others and in the mission of Jesus Christ. Now, this, of course, is not to say in any way that poor people are holy and rich people are always wicked. That's not the purpose of the parable. Life's not that simple. It is instead to say that God has given us all different things. Those who have more have a greater responsibility, but those with little, like the widow with two mites, still have a responsibility to invest what we have for the sake of the kingdom. What might that mean in practice, therefore? What might that mean in practice? Well, what about your time? How do you spend your time? We can invest our time, can't we, for the good of others? We might go on a mission trip. We might help in Sunday school or Adventurers and Discoverers. We might take the time to patiently, over months and years, continue to share the gospel with friends and neighbors. We might help the old ladies, perhaps, who can't get out their house in our street or in the church with shopping or that kind of thing. We're investing our time. And we ought to invest our time. And the more time we have, then the more we need to invest in spiritual things. We need to invest our money as well, of course, in financial giving to the church and perhaps also to other areas where the Lord can use it. We ought to invest our skills. Are the things that you can do that few other people can do? Now, that can be in very simple ways. When we have our lunch on Sunday, some of you are going to be using the skills that you've got and I haven't got in providing some great food for the lunch. That's obviously a very simple way in which we can use our skills. But there are many others. Perhaps you've got DIY skills that other people haven't got. And yes, you can use those for the kingdom. There's always little odd jobs that need doing around the church. There's always perhaps elderly folk in the church who are struggling and need help with that sort of thing. In all kinds of ways, we can use our skills, our time, our money, our energy. I wonder if God was to call us for an audit. I wonder how we would fare. Would we be like the man here who has this accusation made against him that he was wasting his goods? Would the Lord come to us and say, well, actually, you've been wasting a great deal of what I've given to you? Now, you might say, well, hang on a minute here. I'm doing my best. Probably all of us might say, well, I'm doing something, but perhaps I could do more. I'm doing something, but perhaps I could do more. My purpose this evening is not to say that you should do this or you should do that or you should do the other. It's the principle I'm seeking to get across. But I do want to say very clearly that the only way in which this will happen is if our heart is with the Lord. Because our treasure will follow our heart. So it may be that the Lord has spoken through this. If that's the case, that may be a little bit of a warning sign that perhaps we don't love the Lord just as much as we ought to. So before we finish, I want to remind us really of the way in which the Lord Jesus used, as it were, the resources and the gifts that God had given him. He's the perfect man, of course. We can never emulate the Lord Jesus fully, much as though we would love to. But Jesus fulfilled all righteousness. He kept all of the law on our behalf. He was given one life, wasn't it? One in this human body, he was given life. And he poured it all out for the sake of his heavenly Father, for the sake of his kingdom, for the sake of those whom he loves, for our sake. Jesus Christ gave everything to us, and therefore for us to give to him is not a transactional thing, is it? We don't kind of add up the columns and say, well, I've only tithed 9.7% this month, so I better put another £30 in. That's not how we work, is it? Instead, we say, out of the abundance with which God has lavished his love on me, I want to love him and to show my love for him. That's how the Christian mind works. So if we're struggling with this, then I suggest, yes, perhaps we do need to change our behavior in certain ways. Perhaps we need to give more time, more money, more energy, more help, whatever it might be. Perhaps we might need to do that. Perhaps not, I don't know. But if we do need to do that, let's not only do that. Let's realize that what the Lord really wants from us is not our 10 and our 20 pound notes. He wants us. And therefore, the best thing that we can invest, as it were, is our soul, ourself. That's what Jesus did. After all, he poured himself out. He gave up his spirit. And spiritually speaking then, because clearly we're supposed to apply this spiritually as well as materially, spiritually then the Lord wants our heart. our wholehearted commitment to him. And therefore, he's not asking us to write a check. He's asking us to draw near to him, to remember again just how much we are loved, perhaps to recommit ourselves to him, to ask for his help in following him wholeheartedly, devotedly, in order that we might, in the way that we live, become greater and greater friends of God, the God who is the friend of sinners. What an investment that would be. Not just for the good of the world, how much it would help the kingdom, but what an investment it would be for us personally too. You can't put, as it were, an investment in God's bank and fail to get a great rate of return. So that's what Jesus is saying. It's what the world does. They seek after things that benefit themselves. And Jesus is saying here, don't forget, invest in yourself, in pouring out yourself in God's service and drawing close to him is never, ever wasted. You will always, always, always be far better off investing in him than you will in anything else. It's a challenging passage, isn't it? Perhaps that's why sometimes we avoid it a little bit.